Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Research VR podcast number 3. Today, we're joined by leader Peter Lekoff, Christoph Izdebski, and guest starring Thomas Schuller, another cognitive scientist researcher that is joining us for our podcast today. Hello, Thomas.
Hello, everyone.
Hi, guys. So, today we'll be basically pretty much just covering the interesting science that we've been running across and doing research with. Thomas, can you kind of give us a good little background and a little intro about yourself and why you're interested in virtual reality?
Sure. So my background actually is not cognitive science, but it's computer science, so I'm really a hacker. My background, lies in all kind of appliances, applications of computer science. So I'm really focused on making applications that people would use. And I also did a PhD in the past 5 years that was focused on virtual reality applications for therapy. So that was for motor therapy. I did a research in using that technology for stroke rehabilitation. And right now, since 1 year, I'm working for a company in Germany. And there we focus on industrial applications of not only virtual reality, but all kind of new technology. But virtual reality is something that we're just starting right now.
Very cool. So this therapy, you know, with stroke rehabilitation, we're using virtual reality or any kind of the tech that we're kind of been talking about recently for that, or what's the focus and how's the connection?
So when I started doing that, these new kind of virtual reality glasses were not really out already. So I decided to use more kind of a computer game aspect. And for hardware side, we used Kinect to record movements of patients. And we had a large screen display where we then displayed the contents of the game. And the focus was obviously on aiding the rehabilitation process, so let patients train harder or better by observing what was shown on the screen. So from a computer science perspective, it was pretty much the same technologies that we used, that we would also use today to build virtual reality applications. But probably today you wouldn't really call it virtual reality anymore, because obviously we didn't show it on a Oculus glass or something like that. So,
right, that's cool. I mean, it's very relevant to what's been going on in the field nowadays. With you're seeing your own self, and you can do a good little feedback loop with seeing yourself and doing the emotion. You're doing motion, in your own body. So, Absolutely. Actually, that reminds me. Have you seen Leap Motion? Actually, is kind of been featuring that they've been used for muscular rehabilitation.
Yeah. Oh, did
they? Have you seen some of that?
Yeah. No. Actually, so I just talked about my application that I developed during my PhD, but I was quite active in the whole field, and obviously there were many different research groups, and some of them already invested in the kind of early phases of head-mounted displays already. So it was already common to use it also for rehabilitation. However, before Oculus came out, it was still a little bit too cumbersome to use this technology for daily usage in a clinic, obviously. So, I've seen loads of application using all different kinds of hardware technology, from head-mounted displays for the display, but also of the recording side. People were using Leap Motion, people were using Kinect, people were using tracking technologies, like full room tracking technologies, or just equip any kind of therapy instrument that is there in a clinic with sensors and use that information to display feedback on a screen. So it's really a wide field, and all kind of technologies are used there. However, I would still say this whole area of application is, still a bit academic and scientific. It's not really in the daily application. And what people, I think, expect also from this new hype about Oculus is that tracking technologies and display technologies are going to be less expensive and more available and also easier to use. So we really all hope in this field that by these new advances that we have these technologies and these applications in daily usage, maybe in clinics in the coming years. So,
right. Well, it sounds like you're already using the tech for great use cases, you know, for rehabilitation. Where do you see this going? I mean, what is your dream in, let's say, even a year or two with the tech that you're seeing? What would you like to be doing with it and the applications that you can see happening?
Mm-hmm. There's one major thing is that's actually true for all kind of Western societies, I would say. That means we are all aging. And that means that mm-hmm. these kind of diseases are being more common, and that puts really high risks for that we can still actually afford that, right? We have these social insurance companies that are really already on their limits, and we really want to provide a high-quality therapy also for a growing number of patients, right? So what we obviously have to do is making the therapies cheaper. And one way that you can do that is by assigning part of the therapy to the patient using a computer at home, right? So you would have less persons, less therapists that you need for it. So that's really one use case that we really try to get part of the therapy kind of as homework, as you would say. That's one thing. Another really good use case that we also want to have the technology for is recording the data, right? So this whole area of application, therapy and rehabilitation, is something that one person, one therapist, does more by his own personal judgment, and it's not really something that is kind of statistically based, right? So there's this evidence-based therapy that comes out only recently. It's not really something that you see in the everyday life. So by using this recorded data, we could have a huge database that can be investigated for better therapies, faster rehabilitation processes. So something like that is also obviously something that we really look forward to.
Absolutely. Big data and analytics mm-hmm. of that data to kind of see trends within the general population.
Right. Yeah, Apple is doing, right?
Yeah. Right.
Sorry.
Apple HealthKit, right?
I think the general.
Right, the same problem.
No, you know, we call this
I area have a question of application about that, virtual guys. Rehabilitation. I was very excited when they.
Right. So, in virtual rehabilitation, people would always kind of set themselves aside from what is Apple and maybe Xbox game is doing with the Kinect, because those are not really targeted to aid some very specific rehabilitation process, but they are more or less targeted. We call that EXA games, right? That's making exercise through games. That's also very great, but it's not really something that you could use in the real therapy process, where you want to target one specific movement that has to become better or one specific disease. So in these areas, the application has to be more specific than this kind of common EXA game that you see.
I have a question. By the way, feel free to chime in, guys. It's not just me interviewing Thomas at all. And you guys all have your own questions and ideas that we can be talking with him. It's not just me interrogating him. we're trying to facilitate a good discussion.
Let me just add one more thing, since we are also targeting a U.S. American audience. One thing that especially the U.S. American research groups were always very, very fond of this technology is also that you could do remote therapy, right? I mean, that's not really something that is a big problem in Germany, since we are really kind of close together. We don't really have these really remote areas or rural areas. But in the U.S., it's wholly different, right? Sometimes you would just simply don't have access to some therapist in your neighborhood. So that means doing remote therapy could be something that you also reach these people that live in rural areas.
That's really going to be changing a lot of things. And one of the big steps that I've been seeing happening in the health tech industry is now you can Skype with your doctor.
Yeah.
There's even their own applications and their own things that you can play around with. But yes, we're finally, health tech is actually going digital, finally making that jump. And so this is one great arm and leg in that direction.
Well, sometimes it's a little bit bizarre. Like sometimes, I mean, when you break your arm in the night in the US and you go to a hospital, you have good chances. Then when you get your arm x-rays, x-rays actually being sent to India because there's day during night in US and there the doctors analyze it and then send the result back to US.
That's really interesting. I never heard about that, actually.
Yeah, there are huge outsourcing. Yeah, huge outsourcing business, especially during nights where it's expensive to have
doctors there. Well, now, I mean, IBM's Watson is being used to diagnose different diseases.
Yes.
I mean, because that's a great way of approaching that kind of a topic, is because you just, you know, what an AI does, it sees trends and things. So if you give it as much input and as much symptoms, it can see based on what previous diagnosis that it's done, what you might have, and it'll give you like a list of the diseases that you think it thinks it is with confidence levels, and that's a lot better than just a diagnostician like a doctor.
At least an average doctor can support your decision, right? Mentioned this great video or this great post from DeepMotion. Maybe I just looked at it, and maybe Thomas can also open it. We can maybe comment it, because I think it's very interesting. What the audience will see after they click on the link is that the person is basically interacting with its hand with a sleep motion, so a hand tracking device, and you perform certain movements with one finger or the whole hand. You have to spread it. So how would you, Thomas, see this being useful in therapy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one really huge use case in stroke therapy is the finger movements. That's always what comes last in therapy. Like you would always have the more proximal movements earlier back, but really tiny finger movements is very difficult for many stroke patients. That's obviously a huge use case. And I think I would always call it one of the really first applications of virtual rehabilitation was actually finger therapy after stroke. And they used a much more cumbersome device, some kind of hand glove. And also the display was not as nice as the one I see in this video. But it could very well be some kind of new application that came out from this research group. I might look that up, actually.
Right.
Interesting.
The video that we're linking is actually very interesting. It's essentially what the company is doing. What are they called? They're selling is the kind of a mount for your forearm to sit on, and you, in front of the mount, you put a leap motion, and so it's called Virtual Rehab, Virtual Rehab, and basically, they're using gamification and for rehabilitation of your fingers, especially. So you said for stroke patients, finger rehabilitation is usually the last thing. And that's probably not a very good thing, because your fingers are probably one of the most important things about your body. And say even the issue that we have now with rehabilitation is, even if you go to physical therapy and they give you this homework to do, I think I saw statistics on this. It was like the grand majority of people don't do the right homework, as in the exercises that you're supposed to do, and that's only detrimental to them. So if you give them something like this, where it's more of using the gamification of rehabilitation, which kind of really, you know, it goes into your dopamine and reward systems and just plays on that. I mean, it's a good approach.
Definitely.
That you can take for rehabilitation.
I want to bring in a nice example. So we will talk maybe about it later when we have time. Chris and me have been in Hamburg at Klinikum, the university, where we gave a talk about virtual reality. And those were basically, you know, people who do science and also applied medicine. And there was a very interesting person. He was a pilot in the Bundeswehr, so the army. And then he decided, okay, you know, does therapy. So he studied psychology. And he told me that in a certain way, when you have some problems psychologically in your life and you need, you don't can't handle your life anymore, then you have to not be brought to the hospital, and then they train you with very boring computer programs where you have to perform everything, and patients really hate it. So he just bought himself a board game that is like similar, where you have to perform all the same steps, just way more fun, and the patients, you know, they perform better, and it's also more fun for them. So he just lets them, you know, plays his board game for a few hours and then one training session with a computer and then he's okay, yeah, you're good. So you just see clearly that the patient can benefit from something that looks more silly but is, you know, more engaging, right? And in a certain way, that's the same with VR, right? I mean, how many people, you know, smash their screen with a Wii because it's engaging? Accidentally, not on purpose. Right?
Definitely. What the problem that you just mentioned, that people actually don't really do their homework. So that was one of the major drivers behind this. So it came not really from the computer science guys that know what to do with computer science, but more it was more driven, this whole field, by the clinicians, by the researchers themselves, seeing that they were really in need for something that could help them making the therapy more interesting, making it also available at home, helping people at home to show them what they actually have to do, to again explain what the right movements are, and that all using technology. Mm. So it was really driven by the clinicians, this whole area. So they really saw a dire need for something like that. So,
From what I've seen with one of the earlier kind of drives in virtual reality research was actually done for medical therapy. What I remember reading a lot about was chemotherapy patients, and not to aid the therapy itself, which I mean, from my understanding, you don't really do much in a chemotherapy, right? You just sit there and you kind of are plugged in. But I mean, obviously, it's a really terrible place to be in your life with cancer, and you're sitting there losing your hair. So what they were doing actually was looking at time perception and how it differs whenever you give the patients a virtual reality headset and they're in a different environment or they're playing a game or something. And I think it was shown that, like, basically they underestimated the time spent in the chemotherapy clinic than they actually thought. So I'm not sure what the margin or what the range was, but it's, I mean, it's interesting to using these technologies to help basically medicine and to help people get themselves out of worse situations and to feel that, because everything is based on your perception, right? Of your perception of where you are, what you're doing, or how long you're doing it for. So if you can play with those systems, you can, you know, better the person and better their body.
Yeah, and here I have actually a question to Thomas. Like, we spoke, I think, the first episode once about pain relief from VR, and here we speak about time perception and also what you did in your research as rehabilitation. So what, maybe there are other use cases that you see, can imagine, that can be used in a therapeutic way? Mm-hmm. Like, how can be VR used in medical rehabilitation other than that?
So we would have maybe three major different areas in here. So that one would be motor rehabilitation. So that's really physical training that should be aided by it. Another sometimes overlapping area is cognitive rehabilitation. That's something like stroke, for example, has parts of both, right? It is part of motor rehabilitation, so you really have to do exercises, but it's also part of cognitive rehabilitation, that maybe your speech is less, or your seeing is less good than before. So there's all kind of different aspects kind of overlapping in here. And then there's a whole different area of application that's like psychological therapy, right? And that is actually maybe the most advanced area of application. So, for example, you have trauma therapy. One huge application area is for soldiers with PTSD. So they call it exposure therapy. People would basically play some kind of ego shooter-like video game, but what's happening in the game is controlled by a physician. So it would be really controlled by a therapist, and this way the soldiers with this traumatic disorder would be placed in the situation, back in the situation that they had to go through during war. So that is really something that is applied already today. Another area that is also interesting is all kind of pain reliefs. So you might have chronic pain, and problem here is, of course, you have pain, you feel pain while you're doing movements, and because you feel this pain, you don't move. And because you don't move, you feel more pain, right? That's some kind of a really a bad situation that you want to break some way. So today it would usually be done by how do you say that, by drugs or medicine that you take, like pain relievers. Yeah. But certainly you don't want to have those too much, because it's also something that you can get addicted to. So you want to have not too much of that in there. And one very obvious use case is using virtual reality and this immersion and presence feeling in virtual reality to use it to distract people from pain. As simple as it is, you could have kind of any kind of application, any kind of environment, any kind of game could already apply for that, right? Because it really takes you apart from where you are actually right now. And if you then perform movements while you are present and immersed in a different environment, in a different reality, it could help to feel less pain, right? So very obvious use case, and something that we also, with our company Salt and Pepper in Osnabrück right now, start a project in. So we have kind of a research project, a joint research project with three other partners that we team up with to produce something, some virtual reality for pain therapy. Well, there's a clinic, there's another research department of a company from Holland and another development company from Holland, and there's also one more company to it that steers everything and tries to put some good business case behind it. And we're doing that for the coming 2 years, developing an application in real close contact also to clinical daily life usage. And we really, it's only starting right now, so I can't really tell you much about it, but we aim for developing a game, let's say, for chronic patients of the upper limb and help them feel less pain during the therapy.
That's amazing. But let's say
it's fantastic.
The process in medicine, I mean, how you build devices that need to undergo testing, and I mean, also applications and therapies that need to be certified. How would you view the time it needs for a company, or let's say, how long does it take till a new technology in general can be adopted, you know, evaluated, tested on humans, accepted by all the insurance companies and whatsoever?
Yeah, that's a hot topic that you are referring to, Peter.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's why I'm referring
also,
to it.
Well, especially, I don't know, I can't really speak for other countries, but I know that the systems in Germany are pretty restricted. I know also in the US you have to go through, I think it's called FDA, some kind of approval that you need for medical instruments that you could use them then in daily application. There are a couple of ways that you can do that. Either if you really aim to have it as part of a prescribed therapy, you would really have to go through a whole lot of testing and use the tests again, and then getting it approved by some external company. But the other way that you could also go through is more having it as an, I would call it an adjoint therapy, something that you just kind of, you don't really have to do it. You could do your therapy without it, but it would help you, right? So it would just aid the process.
Right.
And this way, you're not in such a strict environment where you would have to prove how much gain you get from that therapy in a couple of days or something. So we as a company, it's much easier, of course, to aim for the latter and have something that you could just use adjoint to your regular therapy that is prescribed. And by having some of those applications out there, I think the process of doing that then properly for a medical device could be eased, because people are getting more used to it and see the benefit a little bit more. So we as a company, as developers, learn what is crucial in this area, and therefore we would say have it easier also to convince people that it's something that should be prescribed actually.
It's very interesting.
It's good that you guys are using things like Microsoft Connect and not like a full-on proprietary system that you're building. Mm. Because Connect, I mean, how much does the Connect cost?
$200.
$200, yep. Exactly. The Leap Motion is $100. Like these are devices made for the mass public for a lot of different things, and now they're actually being used for medical applications. A lot of the times what's happened with medical devices in the past is that they are just specifically made for that medical application. So they build very few units, and those few units cost a lot. And I mean, obviously you don't have as big of a market reach even to patients that are in need, because say either they can't cover it or their insurance will cover it, but then they will start charging them more. I mean, that you run into a lot of issues with medical therapy. But it sounds like what you guys are doing is a very humanitarian kind of an effort.
Well, so you can combine that. Good ethics and good business. But I think also the benefits when you have companies involved, let's say Salt and Pepper with such research, the stance is a little bit different than in general research at universities. So you have great researchers at universities. It's very amazing what people do, but usually in my at least perception, this last step from actually, okay, we have an effect, create a product, despite whether you want to earn money on it or not, but actually create something that people will, download from the App Store or download from the Oculus Store and actually try at home. This is usually just not done because it's either not, very easy or not interesting for them, or it's not beneficial to them at all. So.
Yeah, we have seen so many advanced research prototypes, yes. But the step from a research prototype that has been developed at university to something that is in daily application where you also have some kind of basic support, at least where people could maybe call some hotline and get information about, well, how do I actually use it? That's a whole different level, right? That's not something that a university could really afford to
accomplish,
do, right? They can't accomplish it, right? So I think you see more and more research groups in this area having the same idea that you actually need to move forward to spin off some company that is then able to do this application that they did their research before in daily application. But it's still something that people are struggling with. I think there's not much that is already there in daily application to a reason that it's really difficult to provide this service that is also necessary. Mm. Right?
Sure.
I wanted to ask, so we kind of talked about this, or you briefly kind of glanced over it, was using virtual reality for some kind of a pain management thing. Well, in previous podcasts, Peter has mentioned this one research done for burn patients so the burn patient obviously feels very, you're feeling the pain from burn. And so if you put them in a cold environment, you can start to associate that feeling with, being chilled or cold, which is, I think, a lot better than burn. So that's like obviously a really cool application, but I'm having trouble trying to think of a use case for like, how do you get rid of like joint pain that you're saying with putting them in using presence and a different virtual environment to be in. Can we kind of discuss ideas that we have or things that have actually been done before?
I've actually seen in Italy on the EuroVR conference an example where they had, I think, elderly people that had to perform a certain movement with their hand for training, and they built this device for that, but it wasn't virtual reality with the goggles, and whenever they did it, there was a smiley giving them, feedback, you did it great, and whenever they did it bad, they didn't get a positive feedback. So, I mean, as similar as with the pain from a burned patient, I guess you can just shift your attention away from the pain from your joints towards, I have to perform now the movement.
Yeah, right. Yeah, like that's distraction, and I think that is something that is already very easily achieved by virtual reality. One more, neurological perspective to it. I'm not quite sure if I can put that across properly because I'm not a neuroscientist. But from what I understand about neurologic issues that cause pain, is that the pain is, or maybe the reason for the pain, the trigger for the pain has long passed, and it's now in a chronic phase where the actual trigger for the pain is not anymore present, but it's more a learned pain that you have in your brain, right? So some
psychosomatic.
Yeah. Right, and right. it is something that your brain got used to. You also have these, for example, with phantom limb pain, that is kind of similar. It's not really a learned pain, but it's still something that is your brain got used to that limb, right? And it was taken away, and your brain has to accommodate to that, and that takes a while. And during that process, you feel pain. And one way that you could use virtual reality is to trick the brain into feeling that actually everything was just before that incident happened, right? So you could make an environment where you kind of provide the illusion of, for example, to an amputee, provide the illusion that the arm is still there, that you can still operate it, right? And that you have control over it. And during that process, you could aid the brain in adapting to this new situation, right? Like kind of slowly making clear that there is a new a body image that you have to accommodate to.
So I know there's research done with leg amputees where if they stand up in front of a mirror and they put the amputee and they're looking at themselves, they can start to associate that,
exactly.
You know, the prosthetic leg as them just by looking at themselves. And then you can take that one step further and start to like use a feather and you start, you know, running it over the prosthetic leg, and you almost start to feel that. And so what if you have phantom limb pain and you go in a VR environment, you look down at your, you know, let's say your arm was broken off and you only have up to your elbow is what you have. And so past that, you actually have a fake or you basically have a, you know, computer generated arm when you look down. And so someone is massaging that arm, you know, do you think that could go into helping the phantom limb pain itself? Or maybe do you think that'll actually make you think that you have more of an arm? And then what are the after effects of that? You know, do you take off the headset after that? And what do you feel? Are you supposed to feel more like you have an arm or less that you have an arm? I don't understand.
Good question.
I mean, Yeah,
there is actually loads of research towards this, and especially also from that group. Actually, there was the researchers called Ramachandran. That's I think how
yes, Ramachandran.
And he invented this whole idea with the mirror therapy, where you just place a mirror. And obviously, one very good part of it is that you actually only need a mirror. That's even more available than any Kinect that you can buy. So it has its pluses. However, it also has its minuses. And that's, of course, in the mirror, you can only see what's there in the real life on the other side, and you can't really control exactly what the stimuli are that the patient sees, right? In a virtual reality, you have much more control over what the patient sees. And there are already many researches that has been done to kind of, port this mirror therapy idea into virtual reality applications. And obviously showing a virtual arm is one way that you can do it, and it has been shown and proven that it produces kind of similar effect. However, obviously, this presence experience is something that is really important for this kind of therapy, right? You really have to feel that what you see is your arm. And one hypothesis of my research was actually maybe we shouldn't try to show an actual arm, because that actual arm would always be pre-designed and therefore not look exactly like the arm that the patient has. So it would always be a bit different, right? And this tiny little bit could cause breaks in presence, and therefore the whole illusion is gone, right? So my idea was maybe we could use artificial effects, artificial visual effects, something like really abstract ways, and then train the patients into learning how these artificial effects react to their movements. And then we could have that's still a hypothesis, maybe have a stronger illusion because, well, you really learned how the system reacts to your movement. So you only expect what the system can do, right? And in the other use case where you try to kind of replicate reality, you would always have a tiny difference to actual reality. And that tiny difference can really cause breaks in presence. So that was an idea.
What artificial effects, are you referring to? I mean, what I'm trying to visualize what would be different in terms of just trying to recreate a realistic looking arm on yourself versus, I mean, are you saying more of a cyber kind of or a robotic arm, something like that?
No, maybe not even an arm. So I refer now to my research, which I said was about stroke patients. However, this mirror therapy that we are just now talking about is used in both areas. So it's used for pain rehabilitation. It's also used for stroke rehabilitation. So it's kind of the same. And what I used was, you know, these visuals that you see playing to music if you, for example, use a Windows Media Player or your QuickTime Player or something.
Okay, and these music visualizers.
Right.
Yeah.
So my idea was maybe we could use these types of visualizations that have some kind of symmetric appearance. So you see what is on the left side is always mirroring what is on the right side, because obviously you need to have this mirror effect, right? Otherwise the whole idea would not work. And then use these types of visualizations also driven by music, but then also driven by movement, right? So you have kind of this mixture of visual experience, music towards it, and then movement that gives you a whole interesting experience that also animates the patient to work and to train harder, right? So
you're saying the entire environment is kind of responding to your movement,
right?
In a way that you're almost you're really controlling the you know, the visualizations and the music visualizations around you by your movements.
Exactly. Yeah.
Man, that could feel very powerful, actually. That sounds like you would actually feel super powerful in that kind of an environment. And that could go even beyond into, like, emotional therapy. And, you know, someone who feels, you know, let's say a victim of abuse or, I don't know, I'm just really extrapolating here. But, like, it's you giving a person power in an environment like that could feel... I don't know, I could see great potential therapy use cases for that.
There was also the feedback that we got from patients that we tried the system with. I don't want to exaggerate that, but they said, well, in this therapy, I'm actually achieving something, right? It looks nice what I'm doing, the screen, everything looks really nice, and I have the impression that I'm able to do something, that I'm able to perform in this therapy. And they said sometimes in the common therapies that we are doing, it's always more they always see their their problems and what they can't achieve, right? And in this type of the whole idea of virtual reality applications could be that you kind of more empower the people that they can actually perform and that they are able to do stuff, right? So.
When we speak about what your patients have actually told you, I mean, your study is also published in a book by Springer. And can you maybe talk a little bit more about the results you got out of the study, like not only the feedback from the patients, but also what was the general conclusion?
The audio connection was broken down. So could you rephrase your question?
Oh, sure. Your study is also published as a book, right?
Yeah.
And maybe you could talk a little bit more about the results or the conclusions that you and your colleagues have concluded out of the study. So we have been just talking about the patients actually, you know, giving you a really nice feedback. So was there any other things happening?
Yeah, that was why I said that I wouldn't exaggerate that. Like my research was focused on the computer science side, right? So I was doing a proof of concept study, and that wouldn't really be sufficient to put out some conclusions for the actual use of that. But I would refer then to other studies that has been done and that showed a significant effect of virtual reality applications over common therapies. Referring to my study, I wouldn't conclude anything, but the hypothesis is something that is supported and that we should investigate further in, right? But I wouldn't conclude any actual use for a patient from that. But if we look for other, especially meta studies, that is like reviews that has been done, they show a significant effect of applying virtual reality to patients, for example, stroke patients. There was one study, I think, coming out 2012, that put that forward. However, they also put forward their limitations, and that is actually the different applications that they investigated are so different from each other that you can't actually compare the results very much to each other. So we are still waiting for that really big controlled trial that tries a couple of different applications and tries to figure out more deeply what are the exact properties of a virtual reality that help patients and how much should they train with it and how should it be designed. So these things are still open for investigation, I would say.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting indeed. Where do you guys want this technology to be? I mean, what's one use case that we're not really thinking about? And I'm trying to kind of put ideas out there more for people to start thinking with. I mean, even if it's not just, even if you're not a researcher yourself, but like you want to, you're a developer and you're very interested in virtual reality. What's one way we can think about that you could really help someone, let's say, train themselves to do something? Because I think that this podcast could be like a good discussion that we have here is just applying these research findings that we have into real use case and design applications.
Well, I would put forward one related but absolutely not similar area of application, and that is if we speak about learning, and that is motor learning in therapy is nothing else than just simply learning. You could, of course, have learning as an application for virtual reality in all different areas, right? So, for example, since we with Salt and Pepper focusing actually not so much on the medical application, this is one part that we do, but much more we are focusing on the industrial applications. Certainly there you have training of, for example, assembly workers. So let them train on virtual prototypes of new products, of new machinery. Let them train the processes that they have to do in actual manufacturing later on. Let them train this with virtual objects, for example.
Right. I know they're doing even medical training at the moment. I'm trying to envision exactly how they're doing that. And the only thing I can think about is, you know, having almost a first person perspective of like a real operation being done. Mm-hmm. And it kind of feels like you're sitting there, you know, you're looking over the body itself and looking at what they're doing and trying to replicate it with the hands. Do you guys know much more?
Yeah. When you actually speak about, let's say, surgery and you put those super complex cameras in the body to not invasive operations. One certain issue that came up recently is that came up most likely also longer, but the doctors viewing through these cameras, I mean, their movement in the body of the patient with the tools is not particularly binded to the lenses of the cameras. So that means that you have to do some correction for that. So, I mean, it's very hard to imagine where your tools in the body are right now. So, what you could, for example, do, and I think it's also done, is you have some representation of the body in a certain environment, in the VR on some screen, let's say, for now, but maybe later it will be some VR head-up, where you actually see the position of the tools, because otherwise it's not very trivial to actually see what's happening there. Or recently Google was tweeting about some child who was saved by Google Cardboard.
Yeah, I saw the headline.
Yeah, the idea was that they scanned some dangerous part of the body and displays it in 3D so the doctor could actually see it without invasion and treat the patient better. I think that's important. And what you also have are robots setups that have those tools that you would use in a real person when you actually cut with those tools inside this, like it looks like a body, but it's like a virtual body, obviously. When you cut with the tools inside, you also feel the pressure like it would be tissue. So you can actually feel it in a similar way. So you not only can simulate the video and what you see in the body, but also the force feedback. So systems are expensive, but for doctors, I think they're worth trying.
Right. I think having that let's say you're mentioning about, you know, little cameras and whatnot going into a non-invasive surgery, or just had your tools going in. I'm trying to compare how different it would be from seeing it on just a screen versus a 3D headset. I think, you know, you're missing that huge, that third axis, you know, the Z depth, that because you're not just putting in those you put it in the tools in like a flat plane. This is a body, which is a third dimensional object. So you kind of do need to understand where it's going down, and you can understand depth, and you can understand where each other, which tool is overlapping what, just, you know, through ocular occlusion or something. But that's cool. I mean, I can see a lot going into medical applications. And one of the biggest questions I always get from people is, you know, so what else can you use VR for other than gaming?
And, oh, a lot.
You know, this is, yeah, absolutely.
This is basically what we have been preaching since, you know, months. And I guess it's also something that Soft and Pepper Software Solutions, where Thomas and I are employed, also believes in. I mean, sure, you can do nice entertainment, but in the end, what we really want to see are use cases where you help people to train for some kind of construction work, or you to help them to maybe steer a drone in VR or other things, functional things, where you actually get a benefit out of it.
Right. Let's discuss, guys. Let's throw out ideas for good use cases of VR, and it doesn't have to be with rehab or
marketing.
Medical. Obviously, those are great. Marketing, that's one. Yes. And how could you apply marketing for VR?
You can let your customer experience, let's say, the car that he wants to buy in different colors. He's sitting in VR and he can change the color of the car and see himself sitting inside.
And not even just the customization part, but to actually see, feel what it would be like to be in that environment. And actually, it's funny because that actually exists at the moment. And I've tried it out, and it's called VR Showroom.
Nice.
They were at an SVVR a couple of months ago. And it's basically you walk, you're in an HTC Vive setup, and you walk around the car, this Tesla, and you're customizing the color or whatever. But the more interesting thing about it was that I opened the trunk and I'm like looking inside. I tried to put my hand on the back bumper, but I fell through. I was like, huh. And then I went to go open the door. I, you know, opened the door of the car, and I stepped around the door. Nice. I leaned down and I put my head inside, and then just that motion itself is very, it's going to look exactly like that when you're doing it in real life. So you're getting the initial impressions of what you could be, what it would be like to do those motions, or to what the visuals are going to look like whenever you're doing that with a real car that you don't get with just customizing.
Exactly. They have a similar, a similar setup with, Leap Motion and Oculus Rift. Maybe Thomas can speak more about it.
Yes, so we have done one. That was a also demonstration prototype that we used for a fair that's about space technology. So it was together with a company who manufacture parts of satellites, and obviously, building a satellite is not something that you do kind of in series, and therefore you would really like to plan the whole manufacturing ahead. Therefore, you need to know whether all steps of assembly are actually can actually be done. So they had issues in one project that the assembly workers could actually not reach parts of the satellite where they had to apply other parts of the satellite, right? So during the manufacturing, they had to kind of cope with this problem. But if you have a fully virtual designed, like CAD designed satellite beforehand, you could visualize that and then try to go through all the steps of manufacturing and check whether you could reach all parts of the satellite that you have to work on, right? So that was the whole idea of the prototype that we did. We used Kinect and Leap Motion in order to visualize the movements of the worker, and then you could see there was one part in the satellite that you should be able to reach, and then you could try to reach it, but at the same time you shouldn't touch other parts of the satellite with your body. And it was quite difficult actually to reach, but it did work out, and was quite a huge success also on that fair. So we hope to go on with this project. Right.
You know what? That's a great. I didn't even think about that. Where you actually, when you're making the design for whatever app, like a satellite, take it from a satellite and put it into a car, right? You're creating the what's going to be the engine and every component around it. As you're still designing it in CAD, you actually can step into a person's body, or you know, just virtually, and then see, can I actually reach these components around the engine or around the thing? So as you're developing it, you're actually testing it out. Is that? I mean, is that? Am I getting the idea across correct?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. That's what it's about. And yeah, you have different areas of application. You could also plan assembly lines, for example. There was a request. We discuss all these different applications with our customers. And since we do have some customers from the automotive industry area, they said to us, what would also be really nice is to plan ahead the assembly process on an assembly line, right? So you have a couple of minutes at each station, and you want to optimize that process so that you don't have that the line never stands still, right? So obviously, if you put in some new model, you have to readjust your assembly line, and you could test that on virtual objects already beforehand. That's exactly what we aim with it.
Right. Man, I think every day, every week that I keep thinking about this technology, like another use case just keeps coming to mind. And I love talking to, you know, people like you guys where, I mean, it sounds like you're already applying these ideas into real industrial applications, and companies are already interested in using this tech. I mean, VR is such an open, wide field, and people don't really understand what the hell to do with it. I mean, even us, that we have been thinking about this for such a long time, we're still dumbfounded every time we see a really cool use case application.
That's for sure.
Yeah. The one really was, I was talking to a colleague of mine, and we're discussing telepresence robots. And I mean, right now in Palo Alto, when you go, if you go to downtown to Palo Alto, actually, there's one store completely just dedicated to telepresence robots. And it's funny because no one actually works there except for people that are in these telepresence robots. Yes.
Whoa.
So you're walking on the street. There's three or four of these. I wish I could remember what the brand is. Maybe Rover, or I might be. Don't quote me on that, but I'm sure we'll link it in the show notes. Mm-hmm. But there's these. it looks like a very small Segway, you know, those little hoverboards that everybody is riding now. Except there's a tall kind of body that goes up, and then there's a big screen on top. And in the screen, there's a person sitting, like looking at a webcam. And so there's three or four of those just standing outside the store. And as you're walking on the sidewalk, they literally roll up. They roll up to you, and they say hello. They're like, "Hi, how are you?" I'm like, "Whoa." That's a person. They're like, "Yes." They're like, "Do you want me to show you around the store?" I'm like, "Okay, so follow me."
Serious.
And they turn
great
around.
Great usage process, actually.
Dude, and they walk with you. They roll with you, and then they're showing you things. And then it's funny. As soon as the rover is running out of battery, they take it back. It docks into its own dock, and then they transfer the person into another charged telepresence robot and gets out of there. But that's a very that's not a real life. That's not a person looking robot. Yes, it's just it's a TV screen on wheels. Mm-hmm. It's a monitor on wheels. But I've seen this one video come out of this university in Japan where it was a grandma lying in bed. Mm-hmm. She's bedridden, and her grandson was having his wedding. And so what this research group was doing was they gave her – actually, they were using a Fove headset, which I don't know how they had.
Yeah, it's a good question. It's hard to get, right?
Right. They gave her the Fove headset, and she was sitting in this bed with a headset on, and while they had a kind of a realistic looking robot. I mean, it wasn't looking like a human, but it was a robot with legs and arms there. And basically the groom, her grandson and the bride – basically came up to her and like gave the robot a hug, which she felt like she was getting a real hug from those people, and she was actually being able to be present in a real life environment. So think about even business applications where, you know, instead of doing that $1,000 business trip across the
world, that's what they are used for. You know, and another thing, actually, when the you know, the guy who has a company and owns it, he wants to check on his employee. So for business meetings, I think sometimes, you know, we all know how, you know, internet quality and call quality works. It's not usually optimized. I will also link later a very funny video from College Humor, how actually when, you know, call conferences would be in real life, how it would work. It's a disaster. Mm-hmm. But when you want to check on your employee and see how, you know, how they perform, or you want to quickly see what they're doing, and you have a globalized economy, you know, your quarter in China, your quarter, you know, some company in India, and you want to be everywhere, you kind of can switch. And that's definitely something that a lot of people are using right now. I've seen a lot of cases for that actually on YouTube.
It's cool. We're really going into an interesting real virtual time in this era where we can actually be somewhere and be present and truly present, not just looking at a webcam, but like be present somewhere and have the benefits of that presence itself.
Well, yes, one of our next... Oh, yeah, go on.
No, what I also like to add is, what also changes, basically, is that you couldn't really imagine a virtual reality application without a good experience design, without a story of the world that you are in, right? So it could also, like this gamification aspect that we already touched upon tonight, is something that is... that is inherent to all kind of virtual reality applications. So if you have virtual reality for industrial applications, for manufacturing processes, for training in virtual reality, for training with patients, it will always have some kind of gamified aspect to it, and it will always have a whole lot more of a story, a whole lot more of an experience than simply using the regular desktop application that you get nowadays. So it could also be a very, very nice change of working processes, therapy processes itself. It could make life much more fun, I think.
Yes, yeah. Even with our podcast, I mean, something maybe for our audience, we in a certain way want to do it once in alt space, so you want, you know, to actually interact with each other. And the reason is maybe you notice that we're always using Skype to record each other, so we don't see each other. And I think when you see someone having a conversation on television, you know, all the people sit there, you kind of get the idea when someone wants to say something, when someone starts, but then it just gets the sound, it's somehow very awkward in a certain way. Just don't have this touch to this person. You have a really dense conversation.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of cues, kind of gestural cues that you have whenever the person is actually ending their whatever they're saying. You know, they're going to the end of the sentence. There's a cue where you actually look at the person and your voice kind of gets lower. Or if someone's trying to cue themselves into the conversation, they do certain gestures and things. So there's a lot of things like that are missing. And I mean, I'm seeing the byproducts of that on this podcast. Whenever sometimes we speak over each other and then we stop, and then we try to get the other person to speak. So we do have plans of like kind of transitioning this into an alt space VR application where even listeners could actually join in and well, not participate, but maybe be an audience to the conversation itself. And not only that, but we can also use the shared screen space behind us. You know, you can beam videos up, you can beam up web pages and whatnot. So it could be an actual conference or you know how people do live podcasts and the audience sits there and watches the people talk. We could do that in alt space. So a lot can be gained from that, and not just for us, but for a potential, you know, business research, even social just applications. So I'm always overwhelmed at like how cool this tech is. It still hasn't gone old for me, and I don't think it will for a very long time. The more we start to think of different applications and use cases. I think, Thomas, you were mentioning something about the user experience of this. And I think user experience, I mean, it's become a very big trend for people to start thinking in that sense now. And I'm glad they have. And I think it's mostly due to part of Apple and what they brought to the table. But I think suddenly user experience design has the biggest implications for VR, because before, when you're actually just using a computer, whatever, that's not you, that's not part of you, it's still a very software and computer based thing, and people can still feel the distance between them and that. But VR is as human as technology can get. So you really need to nail the user experience for someone to actually enjoy it, to understand it, and to want to come back to it and to actually, you know, get the benefits from it. So audience, take note. Yeah. Start thinking of user experience. Start learning about human principles and you know, listen to our podcast.
Exactly.
Because that's we love to talk about that and apply these things.
Towards that, there was a book also coming out in the past years. I'm not quite sure when. The author is Jane McGonigal, and the book is called Reality is Broken. And that book was really targeted to what you just said. It was not really targeted to virtual reality, but more to the whole idea of gamification. And it was, yeah, our modern working processes are very much, for the common worker, it's not obvious what actually the real use case is of the work that he's doing, right? So it's always pretty remote, and using gamification aspects, it could just make all processes, all working processes, all everyday life just much more fun, right? And that is something that is known to produce a better motivation, that is known to produce a higher efficiency in all kind of things that you have to perform. So it is something that we could really thrive for, and that it's something that everyone would benefit from, right? It's making things easier and more fun, and it's even more effective. So perfect.
I'm going to play the devil's advocate on the gamification side of things, because I had a professor, he was a HCI researcher, and he...
Human computer interaction.
Yeah, exactly. And his main thing is he looks at computer-mediated communications, and he kind of was talking against the gamification of things. I was taking this class, and he covered just gamification extensively, and he was talking about, like, why do I need achievements for everything? Like, why do I need an achievement for clearing my inbox? Mm. Why do I need an achievement for walking? Mm. And, I mean, I was like, okay, I see where he's coming from, and maybe not everything needs to have, like, a score pop up to it, but maybe... If we don't, I mean, maybe they're taking the gamification too far into actual points and leaderboards and, you know, share it with your friends and then compare yourself.
Oh, yes.
Maybe using the principles of gamification to a certain extent where it's still, you're using it with the same reward that you kind of get for an achievement. I say achievement like an Xbox achievement, you know, like bloop, and it pops up and it's like telling you just did this, but maybe not to the, you develop it not to the point of having points, but to still have the principles in there that make something hooked or very addictive to come back to.
No, exactly. I agree to that. It's not only about having badges popping up and achievements popping up, but like one major aspect of games is also that you have a direct feedback, and that must not be a score, but that can also be a description or some kind of call it a story that you just hook up to, right? That your work that you are doing makes more sense to you because you see the impact that it does, and you see the world that it is kind of building up, growing, right? So that these kind of things, obviously, it's not done by just adding achievements to everything. It's
definitely
something
not,
that must be investigated more deeply. But still, I would still go put forward that idea to go more in this direction and to put more direct feedback and also some kind of story to our software, to all our software actually.
The story is interesting because, say, your actions are actually affecting the way the story goes. Maybe not directly, but indirectly somehow. Instead of giving you points, it's like you're actually changing the direction of the story. And then at the end, instead of like having to share whatever points that you received with your friends, you actually share the conclusion of the story to your friends. You know, you're like, wow, like based on these things, I ended up here, and you know, so I don't know. This is good fuel for thought for everyone. So we've been talking for about an hour now.
Exactly.
I don't know if we have more time to continue this, but this has been a very interesting and fruitful discussion coming from the industrial and medical application of virtual reality and hand tracking and body tracking. And you know, we hope to see more of this happening soon. I'm sure we'll report on it. Thomas, please stay in contact with us, and we'd love to see what comes more from. You said Salt and Peppers is your company?
Yeah, Salt and Pepper Software Solutions. That's the company. We are based in Osnabrück. That's a town in northern Germany. Everyone that's near, just drop by.
We have cool toys there. Very
cool. Cool. How can people reach you, Thomas?
Well, we have our website that I might put forward. That's salt-and-pepper.eu. There you find contact information. You could always contact myself, which is maybe we just put it in the notes.
The show notes, address. Exactly.
So just shoot me a mail. Probably those are the best ways to reach me.
Thomas has also a Twitter that needs
new
followers.
Just recently.
Yes.
I only recently started it. So, you can follow it. It's, actually, I don't know my account.
You can search for Thomas Schüler.
Sure. We'll link all of these in the show notes. We'll have our Twitters in there and Thomas's as well. And
maybe one last thing for our audience. So if you have any fruitful comments, whether you know you don't like something or you enjoyed something, feel free to comment, write to us, because we are doing it basically for you, and we are really concerned that you are getting the most out of this podcast. I mean, it's also very interesting to talk to our guests and to each other. However, we are really want to spread serious applications of VR, right? It's called Research VR. So we think that beyond just entertainment, there is more. And if you have any suggestions, just drop a line or, get in touch.
Suggestions. We have a Twitter page that that we're active on. It's called Research VR Podcast. You just need to search it in the Twitter. We can do it through there.
We have an email address called researchvr@gmail.com. ResearchVRcast.
Yes. ResearchVRcast, and that's the same as our Twitter. The handle itself is ResearchVRcast, but you could just search the name ResearchVR Podcast.
You will find it.
Any kind of feedback is fine. We're the hardware we're still kind of working on, and I'm sure you can notice the differences in sounds and little environmental things that are coming in. Well, currently we're still very early stages in this podcast, and we still haven't optimized everything, so bear with us. So thank you for being an early adopter into this podcast before it blows up big. Let us know if you have actually topics and things, that use cases that we haven't covered yet, or you'd like for it to be covered even more.
Or any people you want to invite, or you know that would join us and would be a very interesting conversation partner.
Absolutely. We're all very easily reachable and active on the internet, so we could talk and discuss.
We're still not famous, so you can actually reach us.
Yes.
Or maybe we are already famous, who knows? If you're listening, we are, right?
Yes. So thank you, Thomas Schüler, for joining us on our third episode of Research VR today. And so from all of us, we thank you.
Dig deeper.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. We're looking forward to seeing more coming out of Salt and Peppers. All right, everybody. Thank you for joining us. And join us either in a week or two for our fourth episode. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.